Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday morning. And we are going to talk about the work of Seamus Heaney this hour of the program. Been waiting some time to do this. He died August 30th. He was often called the greatest Irish poet since Yeats. And he was one of the most widely read poets in the whole world. In 1995, he became the fourth Irishman to win the Nobel Prize in Literature, following William Butler Yeats, who received it in 1923, George Bernard Shaw in 1925, and Samuel Beckett in 1969. He was 74 years old when he died. He was a Roman Catholic native of Northern Ireland, the author of more than 12 collections of poetry, critical essays, and works. And we're going to be talking with a professor at the University of Exeter in Great Britain in just one moment, who teaches literature of the 19th and 20th centuries and is a person who publishes widely on Seamus Heaney. But before we do that, introduce him, I do want to introduce Seamus Heaney. This is probably one of his more famous poems that we read on St. Patrick's Day every year at my house. It's a beautiful poem about those who became before us and before him digging.
Between my finger and my thumb, the squat pen rests, snug as a gun. Under my window, a clean rasping sound when the spade sinks into gravelly ground. My father digging. I look down till his straining rump among the flower beds bends low, comes up 20 years away, stooping in rhythm through potato drills where he was digging. The coarse boot nestled on the lug. The shaft against the inside knee was levered firmly. He rooted out tall tops, buried the bright edge deep, to scatter new potatoes that we picked, loving their cool hardness in our hands. My God, the old man could handle a spade, just like his old man. My grandfather cut more turf in a day than any other man on Toner's Bog. Once I carried him milk in a bottle, corked sloppily with paper. He straightened up to drink it, then fell to right away, nicking and slicing neatly, heaving sods over his shoulder, going down and down for the good turf, digging. The cold smell of potato mould, the squelch and slap of soggy peat, the curt cuts of an edge through living roots awaken in my head. And I've no spade to follow men like them. Between my finger and my thumb, the squat pen rests. I'll dig with it.
Seamus Heaney, and the poem is Digging. Professor Jason Hall teaches literature of the 19th and 20th centuries at the University of Exeter in Great Britain. He's published widely on Seamus Heaney and Victorian poetry. He's the author of Seamus Heaney's Rhythmic Contract and editor of Seamus Heaney Poet, Critic, Translator. Professor Jason Hall, we thank you so much for being with us. Hello.
Thank you very much for having me.
I just love listening to him, and you maybe had a chance to see him live, but I understand when people say they were spellbound by the performances that he gave, and he must have been one heck of a lecturer too, wasn't he?
Absolutely, yeah. He was a great public performer in every sense of the word. He was a very good reader of his own verse, and that's not something that every poet is.
Mm.
He's got a good way of speaking,
mm-hmm.
something that most people only encounter on the page. And I think a very generous reader and talker about his own poetry. So, yeah, something fantastic, spellbinding, as you say, to listen to. And the accent's pretty good, too.
Yeah, the accent's not bad at all. The poetry editor at The New Yorker, Muldoon, said it's almost like he was indistinguishable from the country. He was like a rock star who also happened to be a poet.
Absolutely. I know. He said that to try to contradict or to contrast Heaney with Yeats, because obviously Heaney gets compared to Yeats so often. And the difference in their public persona is something that Muldoon is trying to capture in that. I mean, Yeats commanded, you know, a public audience and spoke on public issues. But Heaney takes it to another level entirely. I mean, he could speak to the Irish about issues in Ireland. He could speak to people across the world. And he had so many followers. He was a literary poet, but he was also a poet for the people. And I guess that's why he has such, a command of the public ear as he does, to the extent that people who like Seamus Heaney's poetry were called Heaney boppers.
Oh, really? Oh, I like that.
Go along and bop away to his poetry.
Heaney boppers. And it is true. And maybe it's because he doesn't talk down to the reader in any way. He makes his poems. Some of them require a little bit more work. And the more you know, the more you can read into his poems. But I know that he's read widely in high school classes in America. And as you said, one of the most widely read poets in the whole world. So he must speak to people like me, the common person.
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, some of his poems do deal with the minutiae of Irish politics or Irish rural life, and so you might have to know a little bit about those subject matters to be able to get the most out of the poem. But he can speak to things that transcend the particularities of his place, of his time, and, you know, that's what makes a great poet, really.
Mm-hmm. Why do you study him so carefully?
That's a good question. I guess because, first of all, I was attracted to the language of the poetry, as so many of his readers are. He's able to turn a phrase very well. He's very good at constructing a balanced line. And he brings you to the immediacy of a situation or an experience with the particularity of the words, like only the greatest poets can. And that's what really inspired me. I guess the ability to engage the materiality of language, talking about objects in a very compelling way, but also talking about language itself as an object. That's great.
Mm-hmm. Let's spend a little bit of time on his early poems. It's been written that, and he writes such beautiful poetry about his rural childhood, poems about potato digging, as we just heard, blackberrying. I love that poem. And then he moves into a different phase of his life and is almost asked to comment on the troubles. But let's talk about those early poems. They really have this wonderful quality, very careful observer of nature, and exalted poetry about milk churning and being on a farm and blackberrying and all of that.
Absolutely. He's fascinated, as a young boy who grows up on a farm is, about what's going on around him, about the way a river runs, the way that fish swim through it, the processes of farming, animal life, plant life. All of that is just a world that opens up to his imagination and that he's able to communicate to other people's imaginations.
And did he stay with that kind of theme all throughout his life? I know he addressed political troubles a little bit later on in his career, but was the force of nature always a force in his poetry?
Absolutely. In the early poetry, the force of nature, the force of the landscape, is very much an Irish landscape, the landscape of his home, of County Derry, of the north of Ireland. Later on, of course, he talks about that as well, but he also talks about global landscapes. In a later poem where he talks about a figure that many people will know from the early poems, the Tollan Man, one of the famous bog poem figures who's buried in this bog for years and years and then, you know, dug into and found by archaeologists. He imagines this figure, who's very much bound to a particular landscape, moving freely through airport security. So he's able to talk about a world that is very modern, but also a world that's very particular and local.
Mm-hmm. As we were talking about his father and his grandfather, he was before him in the poem Digging. I know that you have a poem that you would like to read that's an elegy to his mother, and then I'd like to hear Seamus Heaney read a poem about his brother who died when he was very young. But you have a poem.
I do. It's the eighth poem in an eight-poem sequence called Clearances from a book called The Hall Lantern. And it's a sequence of poems in elegy to his mother. And this particular poem, the last poem in that sequence, is trying to come to terms with absence, the space that was created due to the death of his mother. And he uses the idea of a tree being cut down. And the particular tree in this poem is a chestnut tree that was planted the year of Heaney's birth. So he imagines this tree growing as he grows.
Hmm.
And then when his family moves away from the house, the new owners cut it down. And so there's the absence. So I'll read that poem. I thought of walking round and round a space utterly empty, utterly a source, where the deck chestnut tree had lost its place in our front hedge above the wallflowers. The white chips jumped and jumped and skided high. I heard the hatchets, differentiated, accurate cut, the crack, the sigh and collapse of what luxuriated through the shock tips and wreckage of it all. Deep planted and long gone, my coeval chestnut from a jam jar in a hole, its heft and hush become a bright nowhere, a soul ramifying and forever silent, beyond silence listened for.
That one, very much. Thank you. It was a lovely reading. And this is one I read somewhere when I was reading about his life that, well, this poem will be about his brother who died when he was very young, and this is an early poem from Heaney, The Midterm Break. But I read somewhere that he was buried next to his young brother. Is that right?
That may be true. I believe he's buried in a family plot, so that's very well true. I don't know the accurate answer to that.
Okay. Here is Seamus Heaney with another. We talked about his father and his mother, and this one is about his brother, Midterm Break.
Midterm Break. I sat all morning in the college sick bay, counting bells, nailing classes to a close. Midterm Break. I sat all morning in the college sick bay, counting bells, nailing classes to a close. At 2 o'clock, our neighbors drove me home. In the porch, I met my father crying. He had always taken funerals in his stride. And Big Jim Evans, saying it was a hard blow. The baby cooed and laughed and rocked the pram when I came in, and I was embarrassed by old men standing up to shake my hand and tell me they were sorry for my trouble. Whispers informed strangers I was the eldest, away at school, as my mother held my hand in hers and coughed out angry, tearless sighs. At 10 o'clock the ambulance arrived with the corpse, stanched and bandaged by the nurses. Next morning I went up into the room. Snowdrops and candles soothed the bedside. I saw him for the first time in 6 weeks. Paler now, wearing a poppy bruise on his left temple, he lay in the 4-foot box as in his cot. No gaudy scars. The bumper knocked him clear. A 4-foot box. A foot for every year.
Seamus Heaney and Midterm Break. Boy, every word is understandable in that poem, isn't it?
He makes a particular point of drawing out the syllables and giving attention to each syllable, especially in that last line, a 4-foot box.
Mm-hmm.
For every year. It's very measured. It's mm-hmm. a very moving elegy.
Yeah, it is very moving. He has talked about, and I wonder how much of this we get early in our life, his family obviously plays a huge role in a lot of the early poetry, particularly eldest of 9 children, dad a cattle dealer. He said his mother used to recite lists of affixes and suffixes and Latin roots with their English meanings, rhymes that formed part of her schooling in the early part of the century. Well, with a mom like that, of course you're going to become a world-known poet, right?
Exactly. I know. He had it set out from the beginning. He's talked also about the way in his childhood he would get these almost poetic litanies, not only from his mother, but from the radio.
Right.
He would listen to the weather reports, for example, the shipping news, and hear the place names, you know, Rockall, you know, recited, and hear in them a kind of poetry.
Do you still hear that on the radio?
You can still hear that, yeah. I guess if one listens to the shipping news, there is that available.
That's good to know. We welcome phone calls, too. Some of you listening, I'm sure, Seamus Heaney fans and have poems that are your favorites, or you can help us answer the question as to why he was the most read poet in the whole world and seems to inspire all kinds of people, young people and older people. And much of the poetry is very learned, and some of it is just very direct, like the one that we just heard with an emotion that, I mean, it makes you cry, that poem. So who influenced Seamus Heaney? And we'll answer that question more fully as we carry along here. Here's our phone number for you to join the conversation. The number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. And our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Professor Jason Hall is our guest, joining us from the University of Exeter in Great Britain, where he teaches literature of the 19th and 20th centuries and is the author of Seamus Heaney's Rhythmic Contract and editor of Seamus Heaney Poet, Critic, Translator. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We talk about Seamus Heaney this hour, an hour we've been wanting to do, while he was alive, and certainly since his death on August 30th. He's a man worth celebrating. His poems certainly are. We were going to listen to his Catholicism was very important to him. He was born in Northern Ireland, a Catholic Republican from the North, but he moved to the South, where he lived for a good portion of his life. But Catholicism was a large part of him. Here's one of his poems, and then we'll talk about his faith with our guest. This is titled Mass.
When all the others were away at Mass, I was all hers as we peeled potatoes. They broke the silence, let fall one by one, like solder weeping off the soldering iron. Cold comfort set between us, things to share, gleaming in a bucket of clean water, and again let fall. Little pleasant splashes from each other's work would bring us to our senses. So while the parish priest at her bedside went hammering tongs at the prayers for the dying, and some were responding and some crying, I remembered her head bent towards my head, her breath in mine, our fluent dipping knives, never closer the whole rest of our lives.
Professor Jason Hall, do you know the background of that poem?
That's another poem from the Clearances sequence, so another elegy for his mother. And it's a great poem. I mean, it's a poem that talks about not only, I guess, the background of Catholicism in his life. I mean, in that poem, everybody else is at Mass. But this stolen moment when he's there, and she's there, and they have a great silent communion of their own over this ordinary, everyday, humble task of peeling potatoes. It's a wonderful moment. Yeah. A wonderful moment of closeness between two people.
Yeah, it's a lovely poem. Was he deeply Catholic?
I think he was deeply Catholic in the way that, dogma doesn't really exactly explain. He's Catholic in the way of someone who's brought up in a very rich, ritualized culture, a culture that you can draw on again and again, whether or not you're following, the Sunday service or, you know, going to Mass on the high holidays. He's someone who takes the Latin of the Mass, for example, into his poetry. And in fact, as many of your listeners will know, his last words in a text message, actually, to his wife were in Latin from the Book of Matthew, I believe.
Oh, isn't that something? His last words were in Latin.
Yeah.
Via a text message.
Via text message. So people sometimes say Heaney is a very conventional poet, a poet who's only in touch with spades and potato digging and things like that. Yet he's probably the first poet that we know to have, you know, uttered his last words electronically like that.
Let's talk about some of his political work. Probably later books of poetry he did address the horrors, the critical times that he was living in. in terms of the politics of Northern Ireland. Was he forced into writing about that, or was he a keen and completely involved observer and commentator on all that was going on?
I think it was a situation of a feeling of obligation, I think. I mean, it's an environment, hostile environment, that he grew up in that he couldn't escape. I mean, we've been talking, or the program has been talking about a hostile environment of our own time and of America. And he grew up in a world where bombings and killings and, you know, that kind of retribution was an everyday occurrence, especially in the late 1960s and 1970s. So for a poet who wants to write about his moment, I think there's an urgency, a necessary urgency to deal with that rather than to shirk it. It's been one of the criticisms of Heaney that he has either dealt with it too explicitly or has been ambivalent in his dealing with it, but I think it's something he felt that he had to write about if he wanted to write about his own experience.
Mm-hmm. Well, people expected him to be on a certain side, too. He was
absolutely
criticized for not being an ardent supporter of...
Absolutely, yeah, for not being Republican enough.
Right.
Not coming out and placing his politics on the line in a more explicit way, perhaps.
That's a difficult situation for a poet when you read about... the celebration of the simple, and when you read about his family and potatoes and his mother and dying, to write something equally as important in a different style than all of that, celebrating the ordinary, celebrating the beautiful, and then all of a sudden to have to write about violence and inexplicable actions and deaths of fishermen.
Absolutely. And to imagine that those two facets of his poetry are from the same place, from the same time, and from the same life.
Mm-hmm. We're going to play a little bit of, and give us the background for this, if you would, please, Nothing. Whatever you say, say nothing.
That's a great poem, a poem, well, that really exemplifies the being caught in between positions and being asked to pronounce on a situation. And sometimes silence is a benefit in a situation like that, but it can also be a position in which you run the risk of being accused for being, I don't know, tacitly endorsing something. So it's a very powerful poem about these very issues.
Here's Seamus Heaney.
Religion's never mentioned here, of course. You know them by their eyes and hold your tongue. One side's as bad as the other, never worse. Of the wee six I sing, where to be saved, you only must save face. And whatever you say nothing. Smoke signals are loudmouth compared with us. Maneuverings to find out name and school, with subtle discrimination by addresses, with hardly an exception to the rule that Norman, Ken and Sydney signal prod, and Seamus call me Sean, where surefire pape. O land of password, hand grip, wink and nod, of open minds as open as a trap, where tongues lie coiled as under flame lie wicks, where half of us, as in a wooden horse, were cabined and confined like wily Greeks, besieged within the siege, whispering Morse.
Seamus Heaney, and whatever you say, say nothing. And what he describes, the name and the school, still goes on, doesn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, it goes on all over the world. He's talking about, you know, the, I suppose, inexorability of announcing your position, even if you just open your mouth. Or sometimes it's even in your name. The name Seamus says it all.
Right.
Puts him in a particular camp, it places him in relation to the troubles. Even the place names of the towns in Northern
yes.
Ireland, you know, where you're from, even can become a marker for your particular politics or yeah. the assumed politics you might have.
And did he become fed up with all of that, and that's why he lived a good portion of his life in Dublin and abroad?
I don't know that he became fed up with it. I mean, I guess everyone does become fed up with it. That's an extreme position, which I you know, can't speak for Seamus Heaney about. But certainly I think the decision to move to the Republic of Ireland in 1972 was part of facing, you know, the reality of danger, not just the frustration of the politics of the issue. And so, yes, he chose to move to the South at a moment of intense political turmoil. 1972 is, of course, the year of Bloody Sunday, and continued to live in the Republic the rest of his life with periods abroad in America, most obviously.
Did he spend a lot of time? The nature of a lot of his poems would indicate to me that he just spent hours and hours contemplating, you know, potatoes or the field or a flower or the sunrise or any number of things, any simple things, that he was such a keen observer of the ordinary and the simple that he must have had to have spent a lot of time doing just that, did he?
I think he probably did spend a lot of time thinking about these things. He didn't necessarily spend all of those hours composing the poems. A lot of the pictures that have been in circulation since his death have shown him in his study, in his home. And I think he spent a lot of time there reading and writing. But he was also a poet who knew how to draw inspiration from the moment and could scribble away something and, you know, turn a poem out of a moment's work. So there's a balance, I think, between the thoughtful, you know, reflective poet, the Wordsworthian poet, and the poet of immediacy.
Mm-hmm. Professor Hall, how did he become such a poetry star? What was the road to receiving the Nobel Prize?
Wow, that's a million-dollar question, really. I think a lot of it has to do with, as we said before, his ability to speak to a number of audiences at once. He also comes at the right place and the right time. I mean, as many people have said, he is possibly Yeats's inheritor, his successor. He was born the year Yeats died. It's possibly the case that Ireland was looking for a kind of national poet, and he came of age at a time when people were looking for a new kind of poetry. It was also a fraught time, so a time that demanded big poetry, poetry about issues. And he was able to provide it in a language that was very compelling, also down to earth, and that spoke to a lot of people.
Mm. Was he a good teacher? I know he taught in many places. He taught at St. Joseph's College in Belfast, and he taught at Harvard. I think he taught at Berkeley as well, didn't he?
Yeah, he did teach at Berkeley in the 1970s, and yeah, he had a long-standing relationship with Harvard. He was the Oxford Professor of Poetry. He was a very, very well-respected classroom presence, I think, for all of the reasons that make him a good poet. He was able to talk to people. He was able to communicate his ideas in compelling language, and he could listen. I think most of the anecdotes about Heaney as a person are about his unassuming character. He's not a loud mouth or a talker. He can tell a good joke, but he can also listen, and he's got a wry sense of humor. So all of those things, I think, yeah, make a really good classroom presence.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to another poem. Well, let's see, what do we still have here? Let's do the poem that he wrote, which is kind of an interesting thing to do. Write a poem for the 2004 enlargement of the European Union. Are you serious? Write a poem about this? But he did, didn't he?
He did. Yeah, he was able to write about the things that, you know, can be, you know, occasions, things that sit sort of awkwardly, I guess, if you look at them alongside some of the big political poems or the childhood poems. But yeah, he could do those things.
This one is titled Beacons.
On May Day 2004, there was a great assembly in Phoenix Park when Ireland, as president of the European Union at that time, welcomed the new 10 new nations into the European Union. It was a day when the country took its place among the nations of the world, a day when I was very proud to be part of that welcoming ceremony. I wrote a poem for the occasion, playing on the idea of renewal, on the mythic bird with the Greek name Phoenix. Phoenix renews itself, just as the Union was renewing itself, and the Union
continues to need to renew itself. But Phoenix in Dublin etymology also involves Fionn Uisce, clear water. Phoenix Park is a place of clear water. So I played on that too. But basically, the poem is about drawing a parallel between the arrival in Ireland of the first mythic inhabitants, the Tuatha Dé Danann, who came on May Day as the new nations came. There are many reasons for ratifying the Lisbon Treaty, reasons to do with our political and economic well-being. But the poem speaks mainly for our honour and identity as Europeans. Beacons at Bealtaine. Uisce, water, and Fionn, the water's clear. But dip and find this Gaelic water, Greek. A phoenix flames upon Fionn Uisce here. The May Day hills were burning far and near when our land's first footers beached boats in the creek. In Uisce, Fionn, strange words that soon grew clear. So on a day when newcomers appear, let it be a homecoming, and let us speak the unstrange word and give a welcome here. Move lips, move minds, and make new meanings flare like ancient beacons signalling peak to peak from Middle Sea to North Sea, shining clear as phoenix flames upon Fionn Uisce here.
Beacons, the name of that. Seamus Heaney, written for the 2004 enlargement of the European Union. I have read about him that in the collection of his poems, North, the first half covers 2,000 years of Northern European history, and then the second half reporting on shootings, bombs, and neighborly murders. He obviously, even though some of the poems seem to be extremely simple and straightforward, they're informed by a pretty deep understanding of history, aren't they, and literature.
Absolutely. He was able to, as I said before, tie the very particular and the local to a bigger picture, a bigger historical picture, a global picture. That last poem is a great example. He talks about this very contemporary event and this, you know, united sense of Europe, and relates it to a very Irish particular thing from his own past. He talks about the place of clear water, Fionn Uisce. He actually wrote a poem in his book from 1972, Wintering Out, called Anahúrish, which is a place name, the town where he attended a primary school. And the translation of that Irish name is the place of clear water. So he's drawing these connections between, you know, his own particular past and this global context.
I really like that poem. Do you like that? It's a beautiful poem.
Absolutely. Very beautiful poem.
Yeah.
Very melodic.
We're talking about Seamus Heaney this hour of the program, and you can't just talk about Seamus Heaney. You have to listen to his poetry, and we certainly, this may be the kind of show you don't know how to enter, but some of you listening may have thoughts about Seamus Heaney or poems that you have read that he has written that are particularly meaningful to you or would like to talk or know a great deal about literature and Irish poets and can compare him. He's been compared to Yeats. Would you say that's a fair comparison? Or what it is about his poetry that really made him a poet for many, many people in many different countries? You can reach us by calling 800-486-8655. You don't need to, but you're welcome to. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. And our Facebook page, should you want to leave a message there, is the Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're talking about Seamus Heaney this hour of our program. Seamus Heaney, wonderful poet, Nobel Prize winner, who died on August 30th, and we've been wanting to pay tribute to him ever since then, and so today is the day. Jason Hall is our guest. Professor Hall is in the Department of English at the University of Exeter, and he has studied and written widely about Seamus Heaney. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org. And again, you can reach us on our Facebook page. And that is the Kathleen Dunn Show. So all of those are ways that you can reach us. And as our calls are coming in, let me just ask you for a moment here, Jason, before we go to some of our phone calls, about the phases of the poems in his lifetime. We talked about some of the early poems. We talked about the North poems, which I find particularly gripping. Was there a change in what he wrote about as he grew older? He was never afforded a chance to get really old, but did he change what he wrote about in the last part of his life?
I don't know that there was a great subject or thematic change. I think the same, what Heaney would call preoccupations, the things that were really on his mind, moved him and inspired him throughout his career. I think he became a little bit more willing to draw on the contemporary modern world, to move beyond the world of the Irish farm or, you know, Northern Ireland and its troubles. But the enduring preoccupations, Neil Corcoran has summarized them in one of the recent obituaries, is, you know, morality, domestic relations, affection, obligation, these things, in addition to things like origins, landscape, language itself, I mean, they remained the signatures of his work throughout his career.
Mm-hmm. We had a caller who an email actually, who from Gurney, who would love to hear, and I'm not familiar with this, maybe you are as I describe this, hear the poem about the act of writing, comparing it to go through checkpoints in Ireland. Do you know that poem?
I'm trying to think of which one is on the emailer's mind.
I don't know.
So many of his poems are about the act of writing in one way or another and going through checkpoints. I'm just going to look at North, which is probably where it is. But if you want to take another email, I'll find it.
Okay. Yeah, we can do that or another. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. Was he affected by the troubles? I know that he has written some poems of fishermen and other poems about the North. Did he lose any acquaintances or family members to the Troubles?
He did. He experienced a number of losses in his sort of immediate circle, and cousins and things like that as a result of the Troubles. And there are some very moving elegies about that when the Troubles strike him personally. There's an anecdote that he tells in an early essay about a bomb going off in a building shortly after, I believe it was his wife, left the premises. So the immediacy of it, I mean, the proximity is something that is certainly an issue for Heaney.
Mm-hmm. And just the randomness of those. We've been affected by another horrendous act of violence in America today, those acts that seemingly come out of nowhere, and you can't understand the motivation, and it can affect it. Somebody randomly, it's just horrendous, isn't it?
Absolutely horrendous. I mean, it's something that I don't think people can appreciate unless, you know, it's something you've lived through. It's something that sounds horrible and you know it's, terrific and, you know, abominable event. But to have experienced it, to have endured it for years on end, and for it to be part of the cultural fabric in which you grow up is something that's probably beyond many people's comprehension.
Yes. Yes, it is. I think this may be another of his more famous poems. It's interesting that he just became a star right off the bat, didn't he? He wrote Digging, and I think this is one of his earlier works. Maybe it isn't, but I think it's from, it's from Death of a Naturalist. You want to set this up for us?
Which one? Digging?
Death of a Naturalist.
Oh, Death of a Naturalist, the poem, yeah. That's a great poem. Another one of these, as I was saying earlier, about that delight in being a child, and being a child in the countryside. And, you know, what you can find there and the lessons that the countryside can teach you. It's one of those great poems in the tradition of Wordsworth. You know, there's the famous Wordsworth anecdotes from the prelude where, You know, he's a young boy out sailing, and he's borrowed a boat for the day, and he gets this sense that nature is trying to condition him with its morals. So he feels the mountains are looming up to tell him, you know, you've borrowed this boat, you've stolen this boat, take it back. And there's something like that in this Heaney poem, as though the frogs, you know, these great slime kings are telling him something, or teaching him a lesson about mortality, about death.
Seamus Heaney and Death of a Naturalist.
Death of a Naturalist. All year the flax dam festered in the heart of the townland. Green and heavy-headed, flax had rotted there, weighted down by huge sods. Daily it sweltered in the punishing sun. Bubbles gargled delicately. Blue bottles wove a strong gauze of sound around the smell. There were dragonflies, spotted butterflies. But best of all was the warm, thick slobber of frog spawn that grew like clotted water in the shade of the banks. Here, every spring, I would fill jam potfuls of the jellied specks to range on windowsills at home, on shelves at school, and wait and watch until the fattening dots burst into nimble swimming tadpoles. Miss Walsh would tell me how the daddy frog was called a bullfrog, and how he croaked, and how the mummy frog laid hundreds of little eggs, and this was frog spawn. You could tell the weather by frogs too, for they were yellow in the sun and brown in rain. Then one hot day, when fields were rank with cow dung in the grass, the angry frogs invaded the flax down. I ducked through hedges to a coarse croaking that I hadn't heard before. The air was thick with a bass chorus. Right down the dam, gross-bellied frogs were cocked on sods. Their loose necks pulsed like sails. Some hopped. The slap and plop were obscene threats. Some sat poised like mud grenades, their blunt heads farting. I sickened, turned, and ran. The great slime kings were gathered there for vengeance, and I knew that if I dipped my hand, the spawn would clutch it.
Miss Heaney and Death of a Naturalist. And we're talking about him this hour of the program and welcoming your thoughts, too. We'll take a few phone calls here. The person called, evidently, who had sent us this email, and the poem that Seal was referencing was Haw Lantern. Are you familiar with that, Jason?
Yeah, I've got the book here. Just
oh.
A minute to open it up.
Okay.
I find it among the many books I've scattered on my desk right now.
I'll bet you I have a few, too.
Yeah, the Haw Lantern. Shall I read it?
Would you please?
This is also from the book of the same title. The wintry haw is burning out of season, crab of the thorn, a small light for small people, wanting no more from them but that they keep the wick of self-respect from dying out, not having to blind them with illumination. But sometimes, when your breath plumes in the frost, it takes the roaming shape of Diogenes with his lantern, seeking one just man. So you end up scrutinized from behind the haw. He holds up at eye level on its twig, and you flinch before its bonded pith and stone, its blood prick that you wish would test and clear you, its pecked at ripeness that scans you, then moves on.
Hmm.
It's a great poem, again, about being asked to position yourself, being mm-hmm. put on the spot, being subject to the anxieties that that come with, well, with life, really. I mean, this could be a political poem. It could be a poem also just about learning to live with people.
Right. Let's go back to where we started, and that is this comparison to William Butler Yeats. And I guess it's the comparison is made in terms of, you know, who was the greatest poet? Was it Yeats or was it Heaney? Can you compare what they wrote about at all, their political writings or their use of language or references to ancient times? And is there a comparison to be made here in some way?
I think there's a comparison to be made. I mean, there's the fact that they, you know, they're both poets who take Ireland as a large chunk of their subject matter. It's not the only subject matter they write about, but both of them have the matter of Ireland at the center of their poetry. Both of them become, as I said before, sort of official or de facto, at least, spokespeople for the matter of Ireland. And both people have, or carry around with them, both poets carry around with them, a great sense of anxiety, feeling compelled to talk about Ireland, to talk about also the status of being a poet and a public poet at that. Mm-hmm. Yeats worries about this, and so does Heaney, especially in a poem called Exposure from North, where he says, you know, I sit weighing my responsible tristia. You know, what is it that I need to talk about? I feel responsible and compelled by my listeners and by myself to speak about important things. And what's my obligation there? And I think Yeats and Heaney both felt that. Whether or not that means they were the same kind of poet, the same caliber of poet, or one is better than the other, I don't know that I can answer that with any sincerity tonight.
What a weight that would be, wouldn't it, to have to be the poet who waxes profoundly on every single issue.
Absolutely.
That's a big
responsibility. Once you become, you know, the national poet or
right.
the biggest living poet, that obviously becomes something that you bear around your neck.
Right. Let's go to Jane, a caller from River West, Milwaukee. Hi, Jane.
Hi. Can you hear me all right?
Yes.
I'm calling to express gratitude for your show today, and the timing is most beautiful. First, just a bit about who I am as far as other cultures in the world. From a young age, I became interested enough in other cultures to immerse myself for well over 20 years of my life, complete immersion into two different cultures, going through terrible violence, and another through great struggle for civil rights. And I immersed myself with the people, but I also studied the history and also the poetry of great Chilean poets as well as Chicano poets. And now, today is the day I just moved in to start a new book of my life. I am about to marry on October 10th, an Irishman.
Oh, you are! Congratulations.
And I just watched the movie the last September, and it's so nuanced and beautiful as they dealt with the violence and how it plays in such terrible and unexpected ways. Mm-hmm. And I asked my husband to be, I said, where can I learn more about Irish history and culture? And here I am. I purposely tuned into your show, Kathleen, and you just gave me this gift. It's the most wonderful.
Thank you, Jane. Well, Seamus Heaney gave us the gift, that's for sure. If you don't know his poetry, he's worth listening to. And she makes the point, and you have as well, that he certainly speaks to other cultures that experience upheaval and violence as well. It's in some ways no wonder that he is a poet of our times.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think that he's a touchstone for people who've experienced hardship, have faced civil rights issues in their own lives or cultures. So, you know, that stuff, while it has obviously particular resonances for, you know, the people in Northern Ireland, is stuff that does translate in some ways.
Yeah. Well, I thought we would end the show with Seamus Heaney. Jason, thank you so much for being with us. It was a
thank
lovely
you very
hour.
Much.
Thanks. Jason Hall from the Department of English at the University of Exeter.